When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Maryland sports fans, there's only one sports book in the great state of Maryland with over 50 years experience booking bets and supporting customers. Betfred Sportsbook at Longshots is now open and is the only sports book in Frederick offering cash betting on football, basketball, world soccer, and more. Visit the Betfred Sportsbook at I-270 and MD-85 in Frederick, right next to Longshots off-track betting. Go to betfredsports.com for more information and your chance to win exclusive merchandise. Must be 21 or older. Play responsibly. For help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome out there, rock and rollers, to the 36th edition of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast, recorded here in central London, just off Abbey Road. And this week, we're doing part two of the Kiss biography, Kistory, if you will, on A&E here recently, recapping the 50 years of Kiss. Now, the fact of the matter is, once you get me in action talking about Kiss, it's hard to stop us. There's a lot of things to cover, and although there were some great things in the documentary, new bits and pieces, new information that really turned us on, that was great to learn, we also have to wrap in stuff that we've known previously, or from old interviews, from stuff that we've learned over the years, and talk about the stuff we love. And so on this part, we're going to just take a little bit deeper dive on some of the stuff we didn't really cover in part one. To that end, we're not going to have a big preamble here. The show is already long enough and we're doing part two. But as always, we want to encourage you to follow us on Twitter at @ugly_werewolf and at @actionjack72. Make sure you check out all past episodes at www.uglyamericanwerewolf.libsyn.com and check us out on feedspot.com. We're featured in their top 25 rock music podcasts. So with that, let's just jump right back in part two on A&E's Kistory here on The Wolf.
Pantheon podcast listeners, Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Well, the one thing that I came up on my YouTube feed was that God Gave Rock and Roll to You, a track from Bill and Ted. And I was like, I haven't seen this in a while. Let me take a look at this. So they detailed how it was basically the day before Eric Carr died, or day or two, something like that. He was there. He wasn't on the track. Right. Eric Singer had cut the track, but Carr begged to be in the video, which was sad but cool because it was the last time you're going to see him. Right. But the point of it was that I hadn't seen that video for a long time, and it was for the movie. So they had Kiss in some kind of hockey arena or something.
Or an airline hangar or something like that.
Yeah, it was weird. And then scenes from the movies. But what they had was old stuff from Kiss – like a kind of a retrospective, but it was all the makeup days. And I remember watching that when it came out with you saying, well, that's interesting because you're pretty much glossing over, like they didn't have anything from the early 80s. It was all 70s stuff with Ace and Peter. Like, yeah, you're right. That was the good old days. Are we, what are we doing here? Are we waxing nostalgic? Are we doing something? And so I think that was like the first little piece of maybe they're, you know, maybe they will get back together. Maybe they, something might happen, because if I remember correctly, up till that point, they were always kind of like, yeah, that was a million years ago. It happened, but you know, we're moving on now. And then it seemed like that point in time, maybe they were nostalgic for the good old days of Kiss.
Well, that's interesting. And I'm, of course, I watched the video as well, just to check it out again, realizing that it was Carr's final performance, really, with Kiss. I assume he had on some kind of a wig.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah, because it kind of looked that way. It was awfully thick. And I'm like, there's no way his hair's that thick if he'd been under radiation and had heart surgery and all that stuff. But, yeah, in Kiss Exposed, which came out before Extreme Close-Up, they were kind of celebrating everything they had done in the 80s and like since the breakup of the original band. And like, there were a couple of videos from the makeup days. And I think they ended with Rock and Roll All Night from Australia, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so,
maybe,
yeah.
From like 1980 or something like that. So, you know, they were mixing in a little bit of it. But it was, Exposed was kind of more fun and check out everything we've done now. When they got to Extreme Close-Up, which I think came out while we were in college. I mean, they talk about the Revenge record and on there, don't they?
Yeah, that was basically I think Revenge had just come out.
Yeah.
So that was the latest one. And yeah, they went through. But in that one, they did talk about stuff from the 80s.
Well, yeah, they did. But I think in that one, yes, because they went through the whole history of it. And like, okay, look, Peter and Ace basically kicked themselves out of the band, had to leave on their own accord, or had to leave because drugs forced them. And it's like, and now, you know, we've got a stable band again. They went through the stuff in the 80s, but it was like they were ready to pay some homage to their 70s. You know, it wasn't just about this is what we're doing now. We've grown since then. At that point, they were ready to be a little nostalgic because they've been together about 20 years at that point.
Mm-hmm. And even in the Extreme Close-Up, they did basically say that the 80s were mailed in. Everything, pretty much everything past the, I think the Elder, that was something that was a passion project. And then that kind of went, it didn't do so well. Mm-hmm. And then everything after that was kind of like, yeah, we could have done that a little. We could have worked a little harder on it. We could have done that a little more, just put a little more work into it is what it seemed like they were saying there. And then at the Revenge time, that was the first record. I think that was the first record that Gene had really been involved with Sid for a long time.
Oh,
you know,
see,
it showed up, done the writing, done everything for it. He was back in the band, even though he'd never really left.
Right. Not trying to be a Hollywood mogul or, you know, starting all these 10 different side businesses or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, but, you know, the other thing is they mentioned from around that time that I think really changed things for them, Jackson, is, you know, through the 70s, they keep talking about how Bill O'Coin really is, you know, a forward thinker, you know, and a genius of marketing and all that kind of thing. And his partner, Sean, was a big help to them. And, you know, Neil Bogart himself was huge to them, you know, and having not only Bob Ezrin, but Eddie Kramer, you know, just really helped them out at key times with their music stuff. Like that, they're giving them a lot of credit. Like Bill O'Coin had the idea to have Gene spit fire. Bill O'Coin's idea was to make sure we're never filmed or, you know, photographed without makeup. Bogart, who's like, we're going to have a drum riser or whatever, or, you know, all this kind of different stuff. So that, and so by 82, they lost Peter and Ace. They'd lost Bill O'Coin as their manager. They were not on Casablanca anymore. You know, it all shifted. And they admitted that in the 80s and early 90s, essentially they managed themselves. And then when it was time for them to do the reunion and get back together and do the big thing, like, okay, now we need a badass superstar manager to take care of us, right? You know, and that's when they got Doc McGee or Chip Magoo. If you've seen Scooby-Doo and Kiss and the Rock and Roll Mystery, whatever it was called, love the show. Anyway, they need a dock. So you can see there, no one's really ruddering the ship there for 12, 13, 14 years. I mean, yes, Gene and Paul are straight. They're smart businessmen. They're doing what's in their best interest, at least what they think. But it sounds like you're missing out on, and of course, Paul even produced some of the records. So like, they don't have a manager, they don't have a producer, they're doing everything themselves. They're not asking for help and they're not getting it unless it's from like Desmond Child or somebody like that, you know, which is taken away from who Kiss really are. And I think that explains a lot of the 80s and why, you know, Gene's absent and some of the songs aren't all that memorable and some of the looks are completely regrettable. It's because there's no one at the ship, right?
Are you referring to the Tears Are Falling robe? That could have been a misfire.
Some of the Dayglow stuff is, yeah, it's a little. I mean, even Cinderella's probably looking at it like, what are they dressed up like? You know,
it's interesting you say that too, because when at the beginning of the band, everything was equal, right? Mm-hmm. 25 for everyone. Ace and Peter are gone. Everybody else is a paid employee. So now it's just 50-50, Gene and Paul. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they did miss that. There was nobody there to tell them, let's not do this. Let's do something else. I've got another idea. It was, you know, they ruled the roost, mm-hmm. told everybody else what to do. And then if you've got Gene doing other things, now Paul is really running the whole thing by himself, you know, kind of in Gene's absence. You know, I'm sure he comes to him with, yeah, sounds good. Great. Yeah, let's do it. Fine. So, yeah, I think to your point, you do need that outside counsel, you know, saying, yeah, that's not a good idea. I think we should do this. And they pointed that out with Doc McGee at the reunion, saying, oh, we should, you know, do some club shows. No, club shows is a bad idea. We're going to stadiums. Club sends the wrong message that mm-hmm. we're not ready. We're doing stadiums now. And okay, Doc, you're in charge of this part. Let's go.
And I think that spells a big difference. And I think all that kind of came about, really, back to what you're saying about the Elder, because of the Elder, to be honest with you. I think Creatures of the Night was kind of like a last ditch, tried to save it kind of thing, honestly, because, you know, they got Bob Ezrin back, but now Bob's cocaine use was detrimental, right? I mean, I guess in Destroyer and in the 70s, it was working. He was at the top of his game. Cocaine hadn't taken over his life. He and Peter, I guess, were blowing up all the time, allegedly. But then get to 81, and now his drug use is a problem. It's a concept album for a band of pop rock songs, you know, short, thrash you in the face, big riff songs with sing-along type choruses. Now you're kind of going concept. Obviously, and plus at the time, 1981, you know, the time of Duran Duran and MTV and the New Romantics, right. The techno stuff. And you're not only not Kiss with these kind of odd short haircuts and trimmed down costumes, but you're doing World Without Heroes and
I remember when we saw that, they played a clip of that on Extreme Close-Up, and you and I just saying, what in the world is this? It just didn't fit. It didn't fit at all. I mean, I don't know. Maybe if Gene and Paul had written that thing for somebody else, mm-hmm. another band, that could have worked. But I mean, for Kiss, no. And
they couldn't tour. They couldn't tour because they couldn't sell tickets at this time.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And I feel bad because you had this idea. You wanted to push the boundaries. Okay, you know, I'll give you that. You don't want to do the same thing. Cool. It was just a misfire. Like, it didn't work. Ace is gone, pretty much. And then, to your point, you know, Creatures of the Night is kind of like a rebound deal. But again, Ace is not part of this at all. You're trying – now you're like, oh, we're way in the hole. We're grasping at straws. Mm-hmm. The music business has changed. Yeah, that was a rough time for them.
But yeah, it's too little too late, I feel like, at Creatures of the Night.
Yeah.
And Bob Ezrin, I mean, look – they're talking about making it into a film. Okay, maybe The Elder and all that, it's a concept for a movie and you could have done music to it. But when the movie's then done, it's like, okay, this is just going to be our album. It's going to be Gene's idea. And Ezrin's even like, look, Ace played great on it. And he has a song, Dark Light, on it. He didn't like it. Now, what's weird to me is in the documentary, Ace defends it now, where I don't feel like he did for the longest time. But now he's like, you know, I think it's a good album. It was just the wrong time. I'm like, I don't know when the right time for The Elder is. But here's the thing. Just on the strength, quote unquote, of those two songs, World Without Heroes, and then I Believe in Me, which they made a video for. It's the cheesiest high school musicalist Like, papa, beep, papa, papa, I believe in me. It's so bad. And I'm like, no wonder you couldn't tour that. That's god awful. It's the reason to this day I've still never listened to The Elder all the way through. So people who hear this might say, then you don't have a right to trash it because you haven't even listened to it. You haven't done the whole concept. And I'm like, well, all right, you have a fair point there. But based on sales and based on the strength of the singles, I know it's not that good.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin the rest of Kiss by getting into that.
Yeah, exactly. I can listen to other Kiss stuff to fill my time, you know. I can go deeper.
And that was kind of the one thing that I did kind of like about this new documentary was it's in the extreme close-up. All that stuff was still kind of a little bit raw. Mm-hmm. And now that they've gone past that, they did the reunion. You know, there's a lot of water under the bridge. I don't think they're the best of friends or mm-hmm. friends at all. But at least they can look back and say, you know, like Ace said, maybe it wasn't the worst thing on the face of the earth. I could find some decent parts of it. I think that they can – it just seemed like they were kind of older and wiser in this thing mm-hmm. and really kind of more appreciated the entire ride instead of just, you know, saying that, you know, that Paul and Gene were never wrong, infallible. They made all the right decisions. Yeah, you know what? That was a misfire. The 80s probably right. shouldn't have done a lot of that stuff. But the one thing that I was kind of disappointed about was that you only had Dave Grohl and Tom Morello on mm-hmm. there. I remember hearing an interview with Scott Ian from Anthrax, and he said, basically, if you talk to anybody his age, like that, like early 80s metal guys, and ask them, you know, well, who was your first band? What was the first concert? Who got you into this? They would all, or not all, but maybe 99% say Kiss.
Right.
Everybody loves Kiss. So to just have those two guys, and again, I realize it's A&E. If you put on some of these people, like, who is this guy?
Right.
We would know, no problem. But it was just like, it's only these two guys. Like, you're kind of missing the reach, especially in America. I don't know if you talk to people from Europe, but in America, if you're a hard rock, heavy metal dude, everybody loved Kiss.
Yeah, and Tom Morello had a point there, because he's from Illinois, like suburbs of Chicago or whatever, Midwest, you know, not that far from where I grew up. And that's kind of where Kiss really broke out, not only on the road, but even eventually on the radio. They talked about how the Kiss Army in Terre Haute kind of came ready for bear when the guy refused to play Kiss on the radio station one day, you know, and that was the first effect of the Kiss Army. But, you know, there's a reason they hit in Cleveland and Detroit and places like that, you know, like the hardworking Rust Belt kind of area, because the music kind of made sense. You know, the New Yorks and LAs, they might have been like, oh, look at the New York Dolls. Oh, look at Roxy Music. But for the Midwesterners, you know, Kiss sonically made a lot of sense. And then the makeup, the characters were tough. They weren't girly guys in makeup. They were kind of superheroes in makeup.
Right. And I'm looking at this now. Eric Singer is from Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. So same thing. Midwest dude. I saw an interview with them recently. They said, what's the greatest band that ever, you know, that ever opened for you or you ever played with? And they were talking back and forth. And Singer said Rush. And it was kind of like, he's like, yeah, I saw them on that tour. And they blew everybody out of the water. So not only is he a member of the band, but he is a super fan
yeah.
from back in the day. So yeah, you're right. It really hit with like, yeah, I'm not from New York. I'm not from LA. I'm this working class guy. And yeah, here mm-hmm. are people who are, they were just the outsiders like I am. So yeah, that's put it all together and come up with something that you could get behind is pretty cool.
And I thought, I was with you, I thought I was weak. I'm like, those are the only two guys. Look, now Tom Morello, Rage Against the Machine, Audioslave, he's a big star. He inducted them. He gave them the induction speech into the right. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's a big deal. And it was like, they just wheel Dave Grohl out for all these rock and roll things these days. You know, it's like, he's legit, right? He's legit on two levels. And he knows all about, oh, we got a rock band to talk about. All right, we'll go get Dave Grohl. We need to do a documentary on Sound City. Let's get Dave Grohl to do it. You know, we need someone to talk about how cool Lemmy was. Get Dave Grohl. I mean, he's like the one, you know, it's like,
right.
You're going to let a rock band play at the Grammys? How about the Foo Fighters? You know, I mean, he's like the last man standing, like last of a dying breed kind of thing.
Right. But to your point, if he could talk about anything, rock and roll, then, you know, is he really that big of a fan? I'm sure he loved Kiss, but there are guys who, like, I remember Sebastian Bach said something like he bought a car from someone, a Camaro, because it had a Kiss sticker on the dashboard right. or something. Like, he's a maniac. And I think it would have shown that these people aren't fans. They're like rabid mad dog. Those are the guys that would collect everything Kiss when they put it out. That's how you sell $175 million worth of merchandise, is because kids like that will buy anything they can get their hands on.
Yeah, and Kiss was the Beatles for a lot of guys who went on to be in hard rock and heavy metal bands, you know, and you saw them, but you were also inundated by them, right? Because you got the lunch boxes and the comic books and the trading cards and all the other stuff. It'd be one thing if, like, the Eagles really caught your ear, like, oh man, you know, I really dig Hotel California and I really, you know, whatever. But then the only time you see them is on the cover of a magazine or something like that. Whereas Kiss, you know, your little sister might have a doll, your big brother has the records, you know, they're cultural icons.
Well, and like we talked about on our earlier show about Alive 2, if you were to, maybe you bought that on vinyl when it came out and you opened the gatefold and you saw the picture with all the pyro going off and the drum riser up as high as it would go, and you would think, that's all I want to do. I want to be that cool. I want to be that famous and have all of those people screaming at me. To your point, the Eagles just sat around in jeans. I mean, they put out good music. They were big stars. But I mean, it was like you wanted to be the superhero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just adored. And then there's that concert or the footage from the Rock and Rio deal where it's behind Gene and he's, you know, pumping his fist and there's 200,000 people. It's just this sea. I mean, yeah, I want to do that. I'd love to get to that level. I want to be adored by that many people. I think they missed that spark that they set off in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. Between the fact that they had gone disco and they had gone merch commercial and that they had switched out some members, and then you throw in a concept album that wasn't much of a concept, and, you know, suddenly in America, they're not the same anymore. And they have to go elsewhere in the world to get to where they want to go. Please check out this word from our sponsors.
Oh, wait, we don't have any sponsors.
We got to talk about the Phantoms more. Kiss and the Attack of the Phantoms, or Kiss meets the Phantom of the Park, whichever you prefer. For the longest time, it was Kiss meets the Phantom of the Park on VHS.
Right.
And we had that VHS. And it's campy. It's kind of funny. And we would put it on for a laugh. They did not release the original version, I guess because they were embarrassed by it, to be honest with you. They didn't like it. But the original had more Kiss music in it. And the way it was sequenced, it made a lot more sense in the part in what we didn't see originally, even though we watched it over and over. And you, who have seen it enough, if you saw the new or the old new version that was on Kissology Volume 2 or 3, one of those, I think it's Volume 2, then you would they should have done that in the first place. Why did they take that out? Why did they change it? It was a better movie originally. The music was better, and there were some scenes that they left out that would have made it better as well. There's still no real Peter Criss voice in it, and there's still, you know, a bunch of from Ace. But the funny thing is like, I've seen so many interviews about it over the years, and one was Ace. And it may have been when he was back in the band in the late 90s. It may have been after he was already out. But it's like, yeah, they had to do this acting. Man, I ain't no actor. And then he goes, it's the most Ace thing you may have ever said. It's like, I mean, I can act, but I choose not to. I'm like, yeah, Ace, I've seen Phantom of the Park. You chose not to act while you were acting, okay? And I'm like, that's such an Ace thing to do. Like, I am awesome. But I was just, you know, I just decided not to be awesome at that time, you know?
Well, that's they kind of glossed over that in the new deal. You know, we did it. No one read the script, blah, blah, blah. But I think the point was that, and they talked about this in Extreme Close-Up, they thought, no problem. I mean, acting, we're just playing ourselves. How hard could this be? It's really hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when the wheels really came off, as they started to do the first read-throughs, like, these guys can't. This is awful. So I think they had to rewrite a lot of the script, and tensions were already high with the band. Right. And it's like, now you want me to do this dope I think the script was a lot different in the initial concept, or the concept was different or something. And they're like, this is terrible. I don't like this. I know all the ack was they put that in because that's basically how Ace was communicating with them at that point. He was just kind of making noises because he was totally over it. Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, Chris wouldn't do anything. And so they had to get somebody else to do his voice. So I can only imagine the people who actually were producing this just saw this. It was just a garbage fire. Like, we can't, how are we going to do this? But I will say the first time I ever saw it, I was probably, this had to be like the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And it was on like the midnight, you know, this Saturday on the Midnight Express, Kiss meets the Phantom. Like, oh. What? And so I stayed up. I don't know how we had a TV in the basement. And mm-hmm. so I could sneak down there and watch. And I'm like, this is so awesome. They must have other ones, right? Like, there's got to be a whole series of movies with Kiss does all these things. There wasn't. Right. But I mean, that was my thought of like, this is so, I saw it for who they were. They were like superheroes back then.
Right. And that's what differentiates them from the Eagles or whoever, the Fleetwood Macs. Correct. You know?
And I kind of got over the, it was him or his twin. Insufficient data at the moment, that child. Like, it was all like, I didn't care. It was just great.
Was that Brian James, one of the cops? Who became kind of a big actor. He did stuff with, like, you know, Mel Gibson and...
See, in Blade Runner?
Yeah.
Yes, that was him.
That was Brian James.
Correct.
So that's funny to see him in there. And then the guy who, like, ran the park was eventually on NYPD Blue with Andy Sipowicz. He was, you know, the guy's like, he's just plain sweating. That guy, he continued to act. He was a cop on NYPD Blue for years. Not one of the main guys, but a guy who got like two or three shows a year.
He's one of those dudes that, he was never a leading actor. But yeah, if you watch those things, he's always somewhere. He's the boss or the dad or the coworker that's in what, hey, there he is. Yeah.
The girl who, you know, they have the guy named Young Punks, who then the Phantom turns into robots themselves. She was in Coneheads. Like, I've seen her act in a few things before, so it's funny because anytime I see any of those folks in something else down the line, I'm like, they were in Kiss Meets the Phantom, and everyone's like, huh? What are you talking about?
The best scene in that movie, though, is where they're going through the crowd, and there's the guy that just stops and looks right at the camera.
Yes, the camera's right panning by, like, what are you doing? And he looks right up into it. We always laugh, right? It's like the dude in Star Wars, the stormtrooper who conks his head coming through the door to get R2 and 3PO there.
Correct.
We're always like, watch the dude conk his head. It's like, watch, this guy is going to look right into the camera. And he does it every time, of course.
And I'm sure by the time they figured that out, it was so late. They're like, we only have enough film to get through this thing. We can't edit this out. So just let it fly. And the other thing they show over and over again is when Ace gets thrown and he hits the wall, and it's totally, even though the person's in makeup, you know, it's not Ace. It's not anywhere close to being Ace. There's his face right there.
Yeah. And his black skin, he's African-American, his black skin under his white chin, you know? I mean, it's crazy. But, you know, what's cool is, to me, the Scooby-Doo movie they made basically was, I think, the movie they wanted to make in the first place. You know, because they do go into, I don't want to, no spoiler alerts for anybody who really wants to see the show, but they do go into outer space, and they do go to this faraway world and meet with the Elder and, you know, fight the Destroyer. And, you know, it made a lot more sense. Of course, you know, then you put in Scooby-Doo, where it's, you know, it seems like this fantastic or magical or haunted or whatever thing. It's really just some, you know, some well-heeled person trying to make a buck, or, you know, someone trying to scare somebody off. The two melded together pretty well, I thought, Kiss and Scooby-Doo, and then this kind of extraterrestrial sci-fi thing. It's like, this is really what they kind of wanted the Phantom to be, because it was supposed to be A Hard Day's Night meets Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And this is a lot closer to that than, say, the Phantom.
Okay. I would love to have seen the original script for that, because that's the way Paul described it, and what they got was not anything close to that. That must have been what it was. They just, we got to scrap this. This is not going to work. We have to give them as little lines as possible, yet still have them be the stars of the movie. All right, here we go. And now I'm sure the budget got slashed down to nothing. So we're going to film this at night at Knott's Berry Farm.
And now, okay, we got to change one of your songs so that it's not you telling the kids to destroy the place. It's like the bad robot use.
Correct.
So
I actually kind of like rip and destroy.
Rip and destroy, yeah.
Yeah.
Rip and destroy. And then you hear him in the background going, hey, let's tear this place down. Yeah, it's so bad. Rip. They basically take Hotter Than Hell and make it into Rip and Destroy. And I assume Paul must have changed the lyrics there to fit what he was going to sing.
Somebody posted that not too long ago on Twitter. It was just a concept thing, you know, Kiss meets the Phantom, the soundtrack. And it was like, this needs to happen. Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. Go ahead and do it.
I was going to say, if there's a way to make money, I'm surprised Gene hasn't done it. But I think that really is a sore point with him. I really think the whole Phantom experience is something they kind of wish would go away. What we didn't really talk about in our first session on Kiss was the whole Tom Snyder. Well, we did a little bit, but the Tom Snyder Tomorrow program. We talked about it some, but
yes,
for years. Well,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, and you talk about the time machine to go there and just sit to watch it happen like off stage.
Uh-huh.
It's like watching a car accident. It's just so bad. Ace is so out of control, and he thinks he's the funniest person on the face of the earth, which he was at that point in time.
Right.
And the thing about how, according to Gene, Peter Criss is just loving this because it's rubbing them the wrong way. And if Gene could have reached across and just strangled Ace, he'd have done it.
He would have. You could see it on his face.
Yes.
Could see he's shaking his head. He's like, ugh. Yeah. Meanwhile, Tom... Does Tom just think Ace is funny, or does he know that he's wasted? I mean, Tom's like he's not in on the joke.
Or the fact, too, is like, does Tom realize that this is coming off the rails, and what do I do now? We've got somebody who's obviously – something is up with him. I mean, you've got to be able to tell that. You've got to be able to tell just from what he's saying that you can't hear on the broadcast. Maybe when he first got there, it's like, oh, boy. And then it seems like it's going well because he's laughing, he's making jokes, but you also have to feel the tension on the other side. I think it's interesting that Ace and Peter were sitting next to each other and Paul and Gene on the other side. Maybe if Gene was sitting next to Paul, he could have, you know, kind of just grabbed him, you know, by the hand or something and just said, cool it.
That's enough,
but they had no control over that. And yeah, Tom's just, he certainly does seem like he's fairly oblivious to it.
He does.
Maybe he's like, I don't really interview these guys, like rock and roll guys. I don't know how I got this. But okay, cool. You know, they're just fun guys. They love having fun together.
Woo-hoo. Yeah, it just feeds into it. So no, it's the Tomorrow program. They're in their total makeup, and I think are they in the Dynasty costumes?
Yeah.
So they're pretty big costumes there. The guys in the Shout It Out Loudcast, and if for folks out there who don't know the Shout It Out Loudcast, Tom and Zeus are huge Kiss fans. They've done over 130 shows, and they've had some good guests on. And so every week they're doing a lot of stuff on Kiss, and they did a double episode on the A&E biography. But they mentioned, which they didn't show in the biography, Tom Snyder actually said bass guitar because he was reading it. So it was like Peter Criss on the drums, Gene Simmons, bass guitar. And I think they edited it out of the show.
Okay.
And then they said, and Ace Frehley lead guitar. He goes, no, I don't play the guitar. I play the trout. You know, and so that makes more sense given that Tom said bass. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. Okay.
So now Ace is crazy and he's got that cackle. But the whole, I played a trout, that doesn't make any sense unless you hear Tom Snyder say bass guitar. So that's what starts off the whole thing. I don't know if he hadn't said bass, if he'd just say bass. And then Ace has nowhere to go from there. His Ace is raucous. But, I mean, that's first thing out of his mouth. And he gets it. He gets a big laugh from Tom. And then he's off and running. And I was like, everything I say is gold, Jerry, gold. And he's just cracking himself up. He's cracking Tom up. Peter's there laughing along.
Yeah.
Now, Paul's take on it was, Peter's not laughing because Ace is funny. He's laughing because it's making me and Gene squirm. It's making us uncomfortable. I'm like, he might have been laughing because Ace is funny, Paul. You know, you're not a druggie like he was, and you're not his buddy, you know. But druggie buddies find each other funny. So he might have actually thought Ace was being funny. But, I mean, I think Paul's point is well taken. At that point, they weren't communicating. They didn't get along. Peter was a hair away from being out of the band anyway and didn't want to be with Paul and Gene. I just don't think they understood why Paul and Gene weren't drunk and stoned all the time too. Like, you know, rock and roll is an attitude, at least for Ace and Peter. We come from the street, you gotta have a certain attitude, you gotta have a certain walk. And yeah, you gotta party, man. You know, you're not there to sit in the office in a tie and figure out beats or notes on a scale on a piece of paper. You gotta get out there and live it. Whereas Gene and Paul were like, it's great to party, it's great to have a good time, but you know, we're adults who are working now, and you're not supposed to be wasted all the time. You're not supposed to blow off recordings so you can go to a card game, you know?
And I see their point in that, because especially at that point in time, like by the Dynasty days, mm-hmm. I mean, they were full bore money machine. And no, I can't go out and just get wasted, because I've got to keep my hand on this thing in the right direction. But to the point we were talking about before, once you lose that, once you lose Ace and Peter and that kind of like that insanity, mm-hmm. does it kind of water it down? Because everybody else, I thought it was a little funny with Singer and Tommy Thayer saying, hey, this is great. I mean, this is the greatest, you know, we feel so great playing together. Of course you do. You're getting paid to say that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not going to sit there and badmouth anybody. So you kind of lose that edge, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, without these guys. I mean, yes, they were maniacs, but they kind of gave the rock star legitimacy to the band.
Yeah.
And there was another interview that I remember seeing. I was watching a little bit. It was like, I think it was Oprah. Mm-hmm. It could have been like, this was probably like the mid to late 80s. It was still, you know, the Bruce Kulick days. And Paul and Gene were on to talk about, like, you know, rock and roll and groupies and stuff like that. And there was did you see that?
Yeah.
It was like some kind of like psychologist or whatever. And, you know, Gene's saying, well, you know, it's my duty to be with all these ladies who need my love and attention. But Paul is sitting on the end, and if you watch it, it's really weird, because he's like leaning almost uncomfortably like away.
Oh, really?
Like on the, and so when you watch that, you're like, so what's going on there? Like, they don't look like they're buddies in this thing. It looks like they're out there to promote Kiss and promote the brand, but they would really rather not be sitting right next to each other. At least Paul does. I mean, Gene was sitting there talking about himself and how great he is, so maybe he just lost it, but Paul just looks uncomfortable. So I don't know what was going on then, but I know there was a rift between the two of them that they've always kind of glossed over. They always were like, well, you know, we got the band, you know, we kept the band together, but I kind of think there was a time when they really didn't talk to each other all that much.
Well, you might be right. And it, you know, it was probably there in the 80s when Gene was trying to act and produce and date 10 women and, you know, whatever else Gene's up to. Look, hard worker, mind that doesn't turn off, you know, straight, no booze, no drugs. Good way to be, really. I mean, it'd be hard not to be successful if you work as hard as he does and keep yourself straight, keep yourself in shape like that. But, you know, to Paul's point was, Kiss is really, and a rock star is really all I ever really wanted to be. And we got this big, huge band, and now I'm managing it. You know, you're not really, I mean, you get your part of the manager's fee, Gene, but I'm really managing the band. I'm producing the records. I'm writing the songs. I'm singing lead on more of the songs. I'm coordinating all the stuff with the videos and all that other nonsense, you know? So he's like, I was supposed to have a partner in this. And I think he felt let down for a lot of the 80s.
Right. Like, maybe like, and I would imagine that he probably felt a little panicked if any of these things really worked out for Gene, the producing mm-hmm. or the acting, would he just say, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore. I'll go do something else. You can do Kiss and pay me, you know, what I'm owed off that, but you can do it by yourself. And I think even at the beginning, when he was talking about going with Gene to the, just accompanying him to that upstate deal or whatever, because he knew that this was his guy that was going to take him where he wanted to go. Mm-hmm. He must have been panicked. Like, if Gene really checks out, this is done. It can't go on. And I think even though Paul was always the front man, the presence of Gene Simmons gave it a little more legitimacy too. Like, he was the face.
He's always been the face of the band, and he is the brand. Just talking about Kiss, putting out their front, Paul is the lead singer and the front man. But Gene is the face of Kiss. Paul may be the voice, but Gene is the face. No doubt about it.
And so to lose that, I mean, I think he knew that if Gene really checked out, that would be it. There would be no more Kiss. And then where does that leave him? I mean, I know he's gone on to do, like, I think he did Phantom of the Opera. up in Toronto.
Yeah.
He had to put that in one of those deals.
And he met Eric Singer to do his solo tour, right? He did a solo
tour.
Yeah, club tour, yeah.
Which everybody saw.
Right. Did we hear about that on Extreme Close Up too?
Or just that the last part about he was on my club tour, which everybody saw, and I could just see Gene. Yes, sure, absolutely, yeah. So interesting that they're a little older, a little wiser. The reunion tour it was heartbreaking because you wanted to see them always be together for this, and then they've moved on, and yeah. the old things just never really go away. You know, everybody gets back together, everybody's happy. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, you meet your old girlfriend or something and you think, you know, wait, why did we ever break up? She was great. And then it's like, oh, yeah, now I remember.
This is the same all over again.
You know? Correctamundo. That's what it is.
And that's what's so sad to me. Because, look, Ace and Peter may still be getting, you know, Kiss royalties and stuff like that from back catalogs and stuff like that. But they weren't making millions of dollars. They weren't having huge lives being solo artists. Chris didn't put out that much, didn't tour much. Ace continued to tour, but he also continued to have alcohol problems and legal problems and marital problems and stuff like that. So, I mean, they should have had money to live on, and I'm pretty sure they did, but they didn't have it rolling in. Now it's 96, 97, 98, 99, and you're back. Now, it's hard work, okay? I mean, they worked them hard. They did big shows. The tours went on forever. They made a new album in Psycho Circus, which maybe they didn't get to participate in that much, but then you got to play the songs live and stuff like that. You know, I think the work all of a sudden, because, you know, in their 20s or maybe their early 30s, they're like, I can drink and smoke and snort and do whatever. And then now you're in your 40s, your late 40s, you know, starting to kind of get up there close to 50. It's like, you can't do it that way. You can't like do a bunch of cocaine and stuff all and just, you know, come back the next day and give a great show. And I think, like you said before, Gene and Paul never left the band. They're used to doing big shows. Even if big is now 10,000 instead of 20,000, they're still doing big tours. They never stop their whole careers, right? For Ace and Peter to come back, especially those stadium tours to begin with, that's a lot of pressure, you know. And even if you go back to arenas and amphitheaters, still it's pressure they're not used to and a work schedule. And even in the documentary, Ace is like, suddenly all these days off we were supposed to have are getting filled up with tour dates and interviews and travel. And Ace said way back in the day, look, the 2 hours on stage is great. It's like the travel and it's the other stuff that I have a problem with, you know. And he obviously doesn't know how to take care of himself. That's he'll admit that.
Right. And even though now, as we're, you know, talking about this, he is sober. And I think he just celebrated a anniversary of being sober. So that's excellent for him. But back then, not so much. And to your point, you know, everything is kind of, you're looking at it with fresh eyes again on that tour. Like, oh, yeah, I remember this. I remember playing the shows. I remember being together. And I remember what we used to do in between. And I'm going to have a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the point where they've taken away your days off. They've added more shows. And I mean, I love to party, but I can't do this anymore. And so now what do? Now you feel like, okay, you know, I'm walking around with one broken leg. And the rest of the guys in the band are like, this is not going to work. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to work. And then Peter Criss had to deal about how the stuff that they had was interviews from before.
Right.
But he said something about how, like, he did they got together, they negotiated, they did the first part of the tour. And then he said, and I don't quote, but something like, I've been a good boy. Mm-hmm. I've played along. Now I want to get paid. And they said, you don't understand, or you didn't want to understand. That was never going to be the case. Right. You were always going to be a less share. And it was never going to be equal. And I think it sounded like he was holding out. In his mind, he thought, yeah, we'll do this for a little while. And then we'll get back together equally. Mm-hmm. And that was never going to happen.
It's never going to happen. And I'm just curious as what the numbers are. Because when it came to the Eagles, when they got back together, it was Glenn Frey and Don Henley get double shares. They get, so there's seven shares in the band now. Tim Schmidt, Joe Walsh, Don Felder each get 1X share, and Glenn and Don get 2X, and that's the way it's going to be. And if you have a problem with that, you're out of the band. Well, Tim, you know, Joe's in rehab, so he's like, yeah, I'll take whatever. Tim needed the money. And Felder was like, wait a minute, but I'm still like the CFO of the Eagles Corp, and I'm supposed to be one of the two-thirds, you know, or two share members too. And, you know, Glenn and Don, it's like, no, it's our band. We founded it. We wrote the big songs. Weird superstars outside of the band, and you can take this deal, you can leave it. And so we took it for a while, and then by, you know, the end of the 90s, early 2000s, it just was a problem for Don Felder, and eventually they just said, fine, you're out of the band. And
yeah.
I would love to know what the percentages were. They've been very good about keeping them quiet. I would assume it would be like there's 8 shares, 3 for Gene, 3 for Paul, and 1 for Peter, 1 for Ace, but there's the famous story that Ace got drunk and blabbed to Peter that he's making more than he was. Maybe he's getting a share and a half. I don't know. But that's what really killed Peter and eventually led him to leave, because he found out Ace was getting more than him.
Yeah. And it might not even be shares. It might just be straight cash. We're gonna play this many shows over this many dates, and this is what we will pay you for it. Because I know Gene said something about how Ace was mad because he thought he should be making more money or something like that. And Gene's deal was that he was the one taking all the risk. Gene was.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if they never sold the tickets, which, I mean, come on. Highly unlikely, but still,
right.
Ace was going to get that money. He was going to get paid the agreed upon amount.
Ah.
So that's why I think there might not have been shares. It was just, you know, we're going to give you money.
Mm-hmm.
And then Paul said something about talking to Peter saying, hey, let's go to Australia. I'll pay you $1 million
to do this. Yeah.
And then I don't know how Chris worked the math backwards in his head, but, you know, obviously he thought that was ridiculous because they would be making so much more than that. He wanted an equal amount. But, I mean, to your point, we love you. We'd love to have you in the band, but the days of you having a voice are way gone.
They're gone.
I mean, it's just, yeah. If it wasn't for me, you would be spending the rest of your life playing clubs. And that was the big thing that they kind of brought up, was the reason that you can do this is because of me. We kept the brand going. We kept waving the flag. We've been playing for 20 years on our own. And it's because of that we can do this. So you should be happy. Nobody was happy.
When
it comes to that much money, it's just never going to work out.
Suddenly you just want more. It's not strange for a band to pay a player X per show. And if you're a big time player, yeah, it could be $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 per show, maybe. You know, it can be that high. And then you do X number of shows, you'll make X number of dollars, you know. But yeah, I mean, Paul and Gene own the corporation, and there's a reason they had 2 spare outfits at the ready, 1 spaceman outfit and 1 Catman outfit, because they knew this could happen all over again. I think the first couple of tours went well, and I think I saw them both in the Psycho Circus tour. I actually liked, you know, and they gave them a chance to play their songs, and they did. I saw them, they let do Ace. Ace would get a song kind of like Keith would, you know, for the Stones. And I saw him do 2000 Man. I saw him do New York Groove.
Which I thought that was pretty cool, because I just thought to myself when he went into it, okay, well, this is from the solo album, so that's, you know, we're kind of off the catalog a little bit. I understand that was probably, you know, it was a big song for him, and we were in the Garden, so that was cool. But still, yeah, interesting. I mean, he could have done Shock Me, he could have done something that was on a regular Kiss record, but that was pretty cool.
That was cool, you know, and so you got to see him do a few of those. And it was great to just have everybody back, but then to see Doc McGee say, you know, as good as it was at the beginning, when we, you know, after everybody's excited and they worked at it, and by the end of it, it was bad. Like, the playing had gotten bad, and Ace is out of control again. He had some model who he was dating at the time basically write a book about and sell him out on how, you know, how crazy he would get with the booze and the drugs and how it ruined her life. And I'm like, well, sweetie, I feel bad that your life is ruined, but it'd be one thing if you dated Ace Frehley in the 70s, like, wow, he really got out of control. But it's like, if you date him in the 90s, like, what did you think was going to happen?
Yeah, and you ruined your life, but you're writing this book about it.
Uh-huh.
Do you think if you wrote a book, if you didn't know him, people would have bought it? Probably not.
Probably.
So
that was the sad thing. You know, I mean, they could have. The thing is, if Ace could have kept himself straight, and Peter could have just not been a dick, is the way that I kind of look at it. They could have stayed with the band a lot longer, and they would have made a ton of money. But I do also see their point in that I helped start this. I am a co-founder. And they listed them on every single one of the spots their name came up in the episodes. Peter, Chris, co-founder of KISS. They always gave them their due credit. I'm a co-founder, and yet I'm just a paid employee by you guys. And you tell me I have to be on time. You tell me I have to be sober. You tell me this. You tell me that.
Yeah, the same way you do to the road crew. So yeah. Now I'm just an employee. And that's really where I think that the documentary, not to their fault. I mean, they asked them to be a part of it. That's where it really would have benefited, because I would really have liked to have heard Peter and Ace's recollection of the reunion tour and how it came off the rails, because that would have been interesting, because they got painted in a certain light. It wasn't wrong. I mean, what happened happened. Right. I would have just liked to heard their take on it, especially Peter Criss, because Ace, I think, kind of just gave up. He just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah,
physically. Tired. But Peter, it sounded like he was really unhappy with the pay structure, how he was treated. Mm-hmm. So I just would have liked to hear his take on it, and fresh in that setting, and not from an interview from, I mean, it was probably 10 years before that.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's the, like I said before, because it is now going to be the documentary on KISS, there's no reason they shouldn't have been in. But the fact is, they had that disclaimer. Peter, Chris, and Ace Frehley were asked to participate in this. They declined, and they don't endorse its views. Their lawyers had them put that in there. So it's costing you money. Yeah, if you had been in it, you wouldn't have gotten paid as much as Gene and Paul, and they could have only used stuff that made you look bad or something like that and not taken out the positive stuff. But it cost you money to be in it, and we're missing some firsthand testimony. Whereas now you had to pay your lawyers to not be in it. It has this little BS disclaimer in it. But your voices from interviews, even from your buddy Eddie Trunk Ace, are in there, you know, from over the years, from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. So it's not like they're not in there. It's just you're not sitting down here at the end able to say what you truly feel. And that's, I think, regrettable for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point, yeah, this is it. They're not going to do another one. So we're going to have to take this as the kind of the last one. And it really would have been cool to hear what they had to say. I mean, hell, I would have loved to hear Vinnie Vincent talk for a while, because that would have just been, I mean, he could have done an hour of just insanity about what those days. So I understand it's a lot of time to compress into even two episodes. But yeah, just to have Ace and Peter come back and, I don't know, air it. I don't even know if they would have aired their grievances at this point in time. I mean, time has gone past, but just to hear them recount that would have been a little more interesting.
I agree, because, you know, Bill O'Coin would have been in it, but he passed away. You know, they got everybody who was key, for the most part, to speak in it, who was alive and who could do so. You know, Neil Bogart might not be with us anymore, but let's get who we can get. And not having Ace and Peter in, it's their own fault. I get it, but it's at the same point, I'm like, just do it, man, and take the money. Maybe it's an insult, but, you know, just take it and then talk about it. If they don't use it, that footage will get out somehow, right?
Right. And you can always say that too. Hey, listen, the thing that was in there, that wasn't anything close to what I put out. Yeah, it'll be on YouTube or something. The other thing too that I thought was interesting is Paul on Twitter put out something about how he apologized for the way that he portrayed Bob Ezrin as like this, you know, functioning cocaine you know, addict. Something about, you know, he regretted hurting his feelings or something like that. But I'm like, that really happened. Mm-hmm. Like, I needed to hear that. I needed to hear that he was out of his mind, just to kind of set the picture of what was going on. It wasn't all rosy. And the end result, that Destroyer was fantastic. Okay, cool. How'd you get there? Right. What, you didn't just show up every day. Now, let's just play some things. I wanted to hear that he was this taskmaster, that he was, you know, working probably 14 hours a day because he was on blow. That really happened. Show me what happened. Don't sugarcoat it for me.
Yeah, no, and it's when the cracks started to come in the band. Because to that point, they had toured together relentlessly. They'd made the first few records together with a producer, yes, but, you know, as best they could. And now he was more like, no, we're charting this out. And now Ace, your solo goes, da-na-na-na, da-na-na-na-na. Like, that's how the solo was written, which is not how rock and rollers write solos. You go out and you jam and you feel it and you're like, oh, I think I've got something here. That's what rock and roll is. And yeah, it made Ace, I think especially, feel like they didn't believe in him. He wasn't good enough for them. And he started to crawl into his alcoholic shell a little bit. And it was, you know, after Phantoms, and it was after they put out Rock and Roll Over Love Gun, where you had an Ace Frehley song, Shock Me, where he was was doing lead vocals on it, and on Kiss Alive 2, where it was kind of a minor hit for them, partly because of the novelty of it. Hey, Ace Frehley is singing, but we loved that song, and it gave him some confidence, like, hey, I can go out and do a solo album. And then they, of course, all famously did solo albums, and I think Eddie Kramer gave him a big boost by choosing New York Groove for him. But then he had more power in the band after that, Jackson. Three songs on Dynasty, and three more on Unmasked. Ace Frehley at that point. And he had that power. And Gene and Paul had to cede it to him because he did have the biggest selling solo record. It was the best. I mean, look, his vocals still aren't that good, but I think as a collection of songs, it was the best put together of the four of them. And most of those songs, at least half of them, would have been great Kiss songs. So, and then, you know, side four of Alive 2 had Rocket Ride, whereas, you know, like All American Man and Plaster Caster, like those songs by Gene and Paul aren't that good.
No.
But Ace's stuff kind of is. So he's like, yeah, I deserve this power. But he still wasn't making the most of it, right? He still wasn't playing
right.
His best, you know, or taking care of himself.
Well, and then the other problem, too, is they kind of made reference to this about how, so you've got Ezrin, who is a cocaine enthusiast at that point in time, but can get all this work done. You've got Peter Criss sitting there saying, this guy can out-party me, and he can get everything done. Maybe this isn't such a bad deal. I mean, come on, don't give me a hard time. I can do both. I can keep it under control, which we knew he couldn't. But to Ace's deal, he put out the Origins records a couple years ago, where he records Cold Gin and Parasite. I'm like, man, I know at that point in time, the early days, he really was not confident in his vocals, but it sounds really cool to hear him sing his own songs.
Yeah, especially Cold Gin. I mean, Gene's never been drunk. Why does he sing the Cold Gin song? You know, that
right.
never really made sense. Now, he does it great, and it's a good demon character kind of a song.
It's way better than Paul singing it.
Oh, yeah.
To hear Ace.
Hell, Gin!
Because you know it's Cold Gin time for him, and you know it'll always win.
Yeah.
And really, probably the only thing that keeps us together.
Yeah, and the guys in the Shout It Out Loudcast talk about the Ace cult. And there is a bit of a cult out there that, you know, just adores Ace. Gene and Paul are assholes. He's the real rock star among them. Look, I love Ace. You do too. We've always been lead guitar guys. One fateful night in our sophomore year in the spring where we had double digit drinks. I and maybe a few other kind of things you might smoke. I actually had a conversation with our Ace Frehley poster. And I think you woke up like, hey, is somebody else in the room here with us? Because, well, you'd already had the good sense to pass out. Whereas I'm like, there's another beer or two in the fridge. You know, and I stay at it. And I swear his lips were moving back to me. And I'm like, and I realize that that's not actually happening. I'm like, wow, dude, you are really, you got to slow it down here. But I'm so glad that it was Ace above, say, like Jimmy Page, because, you know, it would be so Ace. Ace would talk to a poster when he was wasted. So
yes.
For me to talk to my Ace poster, I think makes a lot of sense. But, you know, he's an idiot. He doesn't work very hard. Now, since he got sober, you can see his output has really increased.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you like the quality or not, or it's too little too late, you know, I understand that. But in the last decade or so that he's been sober, he's put out a bunch of records, original material, the two Origins records. He's done some tours. So I'm happy he's gotten himself together. But, I mean, Ace is who he is. He's an idiot, and I love him anyway.
I was going to say, he's an idiot, but he's our idiot.
Yeah.
And I think he definitely added, they said right from the beginning, you know, he comes in, he's got two different sneakers on. He can't really stand up straight. Oh, my equilibrium's off. Like, I mean, is he really from outer space?
He might be.
That can't be true, could it? But yeah, he was the spark that kind of gave them the legitimacy, even when they were doing even go back to the Tom Snyder deal. You know what? This is a huge deal. We're being interviewed on this national program, and you show up drunk. Is there any more rock star thing to do than
exactly.
that and just make an ass out of yourself? No, there really isn't. So I think he always was that uncontrollable wild card that you hated to work with because you didn't know what you were going to get. But at the same time, he did add the spark there. Whereas if you had, once you got into the other guys in the band, they were just like, uh-huh, great, super, we love being here.
Right. Yeah.
Couldn't ask for something better. And especially even Vinnie Vincent, who was, I mean, what was he like 12 when he started in the band or something? Like, he got to join this already established deal. You would just be so happy to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'd never heard of Mark St. John before or after. And even Bruce Kulick was essentially a no one mm-hmm. until he got into the band. So yeah, these guys are all just happy to be there. Where Ace is like, you know, take it or leave it.
Right. Well, you saw the photos and we know the stories. Once they picked up Peter, they tried it as a trio for a little while, right? It was like, got mm-hmm. Gene and Paul's songs. Peter's got that voice. You got a three-part harmony. You've got enough singers in the band. Let's try it. But the sound just wasn't quite there yet. It's like, okay, we need a lead guitar player. They try Bob Kulick. They try some other folks. But it was when Ace came into play, like, that's it. Whatever it is, whatever chemistry is, like you don't plan to fall in love with somebody, but then you see him, you talk to him, you get to know him, and all of a sudden you feel this thing, like, what is it? It must be love. Like, when you hear this sound, like, that's it. That's the sound. And then it's the four of them. And that was always it, really. And then, so without Ace, look, and Tommy does a great Ace impersonation. He does better than Ace can really do himself these days.
Right.
So as far as giving the people the best show, you should see Tommy over Ace right now with Kiss. However, Ace has that certain something that you can't bottle, that you can't make a Mego toy out of. There's some kind of special chemistry, magic, and it's just, look, it's weird the way talent is dispersed. You know, Michael Jordan's the greatest basketball player on the earth, or his kids are going to be great, right? Well, no, they barely played in college, you know.
Yeah.
Part of that is drive. They don't need to be the best basketball player in the world to still be filthy rich. But, you know, yeah, it's like talent gets sprinkled out in just the oddest, weirdest places. And this talent or charisma Ace has is special. But, yeah, it comes in a package of idiocy that waters it down, you know, and keeps it from being what it could be.
Yeah, and there was a comment after this show came out about the first Alive record and how all of these, you know, somebody said, I can't tell you the number of guitarists that tell me they picked up a guitar after they listened to Ace on Alive, the first Alive record. And to see even interviews today with younger guys who just sit there and just eat up everything that he has to say. Oh, you know, here's how I play this. Like, he starts with the bend or something. Like, oh, I never knew that it was like that. He doesn't play. It's not super flashy. It's not super fast. But he just has this quality that it's kind of somewhere in the middle. He's not Eddie Van Halen. He's not Tommy Iommi with the riffs, but he has his own. If you hear it, that's Ace. Like, even if you've never heard the song before, if you heard him play it, he's got that Ace quality about it that just added to the coolness of the band.
He has a very distinct tone and style. You can pick it out really easily. And his solos made sense. You know, they start in a certain place, they build to a certain point, they end, boom, and then you're right back, you know, to the final verse or whatever, or to the end of the chorus. And yeah, he brought something special to them. But just like they said at the end of the documentary, they couldn't have gotten where they got without Ace and Peter, but they couldn't have stayed there or maintained it with them.
Uh-huh.
And it's just true. Ace is not built for that physically. Peter, it seemed it was more of a personality thing. But I think with Ace, it's just like, I can't do all this work, man. I'm tired,
yeah.
You know?
I mean, like you said, never the hardest working man. But that's the way Peter Criss really came across. It's just kind of this malcontent,
mm-hmm.
you know, oh, I'm going to point this out. I'll never be satisfied with anything that I have. So to your point before, now you've got Eric Singer and Tommy Thayer, and there are facsimiles. And no, it's not the same two guys, but they're going to be on. They're going to be perfect every single time you see them. So from a show point, like they talked about when they made Alive, do you want to hear the mistakes over and over again,
mm-hmm.
or do you want to hear perfection? And with those two guys, you get perfection every time.
Yeah, and at this point, look, Peter would be in his 70s, too old
yeah.
to be Kiss on stage. Maybe he could do Charlie Watts stuff, but to do Kiss for 2 hours, I don't think so. Now, look, Eric Singer's not a kid anymore. He's in his 50s if he's not 60. I mean, he's pretty old at this point, but he has kept himself in great shape and has been doing it for so long at this level and actually has a fairly decent voice. Not as good as Peter's. Peter may have had the best voice of everyone in the band, and that includes Paul, as far as singing his songs, too.
Right.
I think he hits them really well, but he has a nice voice. But he couldn't still be in the band. Ace could, but I don't think that he should.
And if Ace was still in the band, you'd have to probably play half the shows in the same amount of time to give him the time. But yeah, and you're right, because I mean, he's old now too. And mm-hmm. even though he is sober, he beat himself up physically. I mean, you know, there's the famous story of the DeLorean crash where, you know, they say to him, "Were you wasted?" And he comes back in Ace fashion and says, "I was beyond wasted." You can't beat yourself up over and over and over again. I mean, he's frail at this point in time. He can still play, and that's cool. But night after night on these huge arena shows, no. He just can't take it anymore.
Well, with those boots on, man, I can't believe there isn't more footage of him just falling the fuck down. Seriously. I mean, I'm like, I couldn't walk in those things sober with all the gear on, too. And then, you know, you got to do the deuce, you know, shake or whatever. I'm like, eh.
Yeah.
You know.
And after, you know, four or five Crown Royals, too, it's getting hot up here.
Yeah, mine would have to be like really fat at the bottom, you know, to like pyramid kind of thing, just to make sure I had that reinforcement. But then I really wouldn't be able to walk. I just have to stand there the whole show.
Your regularly scheduled program will return after a few moments.
This is the end, right? End of the road. No more after this, and probably a good thing.
Yeah, we were talking about this in the last part of the show. They would have to do something. I saw them on the end of the road. Okay, they would have to do something super extra special for me to get. I mean, if they came back and said, "We're doing another tour," come on now. Mm-hmm. First of all, you lied to me. Second of all, what could you possibly do to make me want to come out and see you again? So to your point, yeah, this should just be the giant send-off, and then everybody can go on and do their own thing.
Right. So hopefully so, you know, and I guess Peter's pretty well retired at this point, you know, has money and doesn't need to work. And
he apparently is going to be on the next John 5 record in some capacity, a song or two. So, I mean, it would be cool to hear him play. But yeah, he is retired. I don't think he's doing anything. Ace is, well, I mean, he's going to be on tour with Alice Cooper. So that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But and his origin records were pretty cool just to hear him. Because I know he's not a huge, he doesn't really want to write songs. That's a lot of back. I don't really want to work.
Mm-hmm.
So to hear him do the old stuff, Parasite, Cold Gin, and then do some of the songs that he loves, covers of.
Yeah, like White Room cool. and stuff like that. Yeah. Good stuff. You know, look, I support him. I buy his records.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always love them. Sometimes I don't give them more than one listen. But they have cool artwork. Takes me back to a time, and I support Ace Frehley. Even though, you know, I didn't make Monster. I didn't buy Sonic Boom. You know, I didn't buy all that stuff. Because my Kiss has enough of my money. You know, I'd rather get a re-released version, or maybe I need to go back and finally listen to The Elder, right? I don't need to listen to Monster or Sonic Boom. You know, do you play anything from those records? Not really. Certainly not on the End of the Road tour, where they want to hear, you know, just all the greatest stuff, mostly from the 70s, maybe a little bit from the 80s, but it's mostly all from the 70s, as it should be. I'm happy to close the book on Kiss. Now, like I said, if they came to London one more time on this End of the Road tour, I didn't think they were, because we saw them at the O2, and it was supposed to be, when we come to your town, that's it, we're not going back there anymore. We're going to go hit a lot of other towns, but, you know, we're not coming back. And maybe they're going to play someplace else in England. They're going to play, you know, they play like the Download Festival. I think Kiss is one night and Iron Maiden's another night, as far as headliners of the Download or one of those big ones in 2022. So that's technically not London. It'll be outside of London. I'm not a festival guy. I don't want to be in that mass of people. I certainly don't want to be there all day. I don't care how good the lineup is. Just give me one band, and I'm probably going to leave before the last song anyway so I can beat the traffic. You know? That's just kind of where I am now. Because, you know, like, do I need to see Rock and Roll All Night, you know, for the 10th time? Probably not. So, you know, if I can get out 5 minutes early, it's like a 30-minute advantage.
Right.
You know, getting out of there. You know, if they came to London, my daughter's old enough to maybe go through the whole show, I would probably consider it if she really wanted. But I'm happy to say I've seen my last Kiss show. Now, do you think there's going to be some kind of last event where you do see the likes of a Bruce Kulick, or maybe Ace and Peter? Maybe Vinny would shock me. But yeah. he did... He did show up, you know, it's like he played with Gene and Paul at some acoustic thing in the last couple of years. You know, he's
he
like,
did that deal for Gene Simmons' Vault. Mm-hmm. I know that he played that. That was not a Paul thing. I would love to see that. But after this documentary, I don't know if they would really have to pay them well to come out and do that. But it would be fantastic. I think Bruce Kulick would do it in a heartbeat. He mm-hmm. sounds like he's made his peace and is cool and has moved on. And just a real solid guy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Vinny, I think, is an insane person.
Right.
So it could be a deal where they make the deal and he just never shows up. I don't know. I don't know if he can still play, but that would be cool if they could, just for the sake of the fans, get everybody back for one deal.
Just, yeah, one more time. I don't know. I don't know how you would do it. I mean, you're going to put them in the makeup and let them come out and do it? I wouldn't let Peter play the drums. But if he wants to come out and sing Beth or Black Diamond, they're playing Black Diamond on this tour, let him sing it. Eric can sit behind the drums and bang him out, and Peter could come on stage and sing the song. Maybe could let Ace come in and do whatever it is, New York Groove or Shock Me or whatever is appropriate. Let him do Cold Gin, mm-hmm. maybe. That would freak the people out.
That would be cool.
And then they could all sing together for Rock and Roll All Night or something like that. But you can't bring Bruce out in makeup. You're going to have a third Ace out there. You can't bring Vinny out there. Although, if anyone needs to cover their face, it's Vinny. My God. That poor, unattractive man. It's like his face melted off. Like, you know, in the Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's like he had 5 seconds of that, you know, when he was 12 years old, and he's never recovered, you know. Ugh. But I doubt that.
Yeah.
But would there be anybody else?
Yeah. It would be so far-fetched. Now, I mean, I never thought they'd do that reunion with the acoustic deal.
Mm-hmm.
So who am I to say? But at this point in time, with this documentary, that I don't know if the relationship is beyond repair. And would it take a sum of money? I mean, let's face it, there is a sum of money somewhere that would make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
Are they willing to part with it for what they get? I don't know.
I mean, that's the other thing, too. It's like, I'll pay you $50,000 for the documentary, but then you don't get any royalties from the documentary. And then, you know, the other two get all these royalties because it's a hit on A&E and they play it over and over. I got it on British YouTube, the whole thing. And then, but it's in like 4 minute clips, which is kind of annoying. But instead of like 2.5, 3 minutes of commercials like you had on A&E, it's like 15 seconds and then it's back.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually a pretty efficient way to be able to rewatch it all. And that's what I've been doing here over this last couple of weeks. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was a great documentary. I loved the early days stuff. I loved anything behind the scenes and just talk about how they got studio time and how Eddie Kramer got into the picture. Because, you know, like I said, all these interviews, Kiss Exposed, Kiss Extreme Close-Up, all the other interviews and behind the musics and whatever it is, we commit all that stuff to memory because we're super fans, you know? So
Right. Anytime
there's a new nugget that comes out, that's like, oh man, you know, it's cool. I didn't know that kind of thing. I love, and you know, that's why I'm a sucker for any good documentary on a band. But Kiss has already been so well documented. The fact that they did shed some new light, or and to see Gene just as a human being, because in those other ones, he's just, I'm the greatest. I've had sex with everyone's mother. I'm a multi-bazillionaire. I invented stage lighting. You know, he's Mr. Big Time. But to see now that, okay, yeah, my ego was out of control. That was a problem. He has a little humility now and can appreciate it a little bit more. I'm not saying Paul isn't appreciative of it, because I think he is. But it seems like axes to grind or stuff that's still a bother to him was as big on the agenda as showing his appreciation.
Mm, yeah, and I would agree with you. And it was, and that's the way I went into this thing, saying, okay, you're going to have to do something to impress me, because we've seen everything a million times. And yeah, they did have some cool stuff in there. And I appreciated, I think I went into it saying I have kind of low expectations, because it's really, for somebody who had kind of has a, yeah, I've heard of them, yeah, you know, Kiss, 70s, okay. But to bring up some new stuff, especially the early stuff, like you said, is really cool. And to kind of see that they've maybe gone past they really realized that it's all about the fans, that that's what's kept them alive for so long. And that there was a point in time where they were on autopilot,
mm-hmm.
and that fans carried them through that. They were very appreciative of that.
And they returned that appreciation with what we really wanted, which was
correct.
The bombastic 70s stage show with the original guys. And then, okay, the original guys are gone. Give us the same stage show, right? You know, continue to push the limits, you know, make it cool. And Paul even said that we couldn't just give them the show that they remember because shows had progressed past that. You know, it had to be as big in their mind, but also in touch with today. And, you know, this end of the world thing's crazy where Paul kind of flies all the way to the back of the arena and they come down on the things. It's just, it's an assault on your senses, but that's what Kiss always was supposed to be, a show, an entertainment spectacle to rock and roll.
Right. Where you walk out of the arena like, man, I just got beat up. I got beat up for, you know, 2.5 hours or wherever they play. Yeah, with the lights and the flames and the stage moving around and the music. And yeah, the thing with Paul, especially if you're sitting in the back where he comes out to kind of midway or maybe even past midway and does the couple of songs out there, that's pretty cool. To put it all together, yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic show. But I mean, imagine back in the day when you were talking to the Ace poster thinking, that, I mean, we thought the same thing. There's no way in a million years, there's no way that we'll ever see them get back together. And then there you are sitting there saying, I can't believe this is happening. And it's, I mean, we didn't get to see them in the 70s, but like that first reunion tour, that had to be about what Alive 2 was.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They designed it that way. Like, the stage and the costumes and everything. And we're like, oh my God, I'm so glad we got to this point, you know? Seriously, because when I really started to get into Kiss, I knew Kiss in the 70s, but I was a little kid. And then in the 80s, they were kind of just another band, hard rock band. You know, yeah, they had some songs that I knew. But then it was in the late 80s, I just kind of got into Kiss and I got into the makeup part of it, thinking, man, I'm sorry that I missed this. And I'd really like it to come back somehow. And I'm going to follow Kiss. And, you know, we saw him on the Revenge Tour, which was great. But it was still like, I would trade anything to be able to see Kiss in their whole thing again. And it wasn't really that long after that that it happened.
No, and I remember being in Daytona watching the Revenge show saying, yeah, this is cool. And they've gone to like the black leather outfits. You know, they're a little more hip than they have been. But yeah, it really would be nice if only there was a way that they could all get back together. But I know that'll probably never happen because they're all mad at each other. Yeah, to be sitting there in Madison Square Garden with, I know I went with two of my brothers and some other rando guy, but just saying, I never thought this day would happen. I never, and then we were all saying the same thing. I think everybody in Madison Square Garden was saying the same thing. This was never going to happen. Because I looked out, there were some crusty people there who maybe had seen them originally, but most of the people were like us. You just grown up listening to Alive 1 and 2 saying, man, I wish I could go. So now here I am.
I know, because we were just a little young for it. Although, I mean, I think the guys in the Shout Out Loudcast are like the same age or thereabouts. Like he was talking about, he was 6 years old when he got Dynasty. I'm like, well, that's when I would have gotten Dynasty if I got it when it first come out. But I didn't get records when I was 6 years old, you know?
Right. Obviously, they had someone a little bit cooler in their lives to guide them down the path.
That wraps up part two of our two-part series on Kiss, the Kistery documentary from A&E, a really career-spanning and now defining documentary on the band Kiss. And whether you are a huge fan, you're a casual fan, you liked them in the 70s and you grew out of them, and you just want to learn a little bit more about this incredible band and all the ups and downs and trials and tribulations, I highly recommend it. It was well-produced. It was well made. It's regrettable that Ace Frehley and Peter Criss elected not to participate. But that is what it is. All Kiss fans know that that's just the way it is these days. And we hope they are able to wrap up their end of the road tour, hit all their dates, go out on a high note, and leave us remembering how great they were live. As usual, we want to know, did we get something right? Did we get something wrong? Did we miss the point? Please tell us. Tweet us at @ugly_werewolf or at @actionjack72. Make sure you check out all of our past episodes at www.uglyamericanwerewolf.libsyn.com. Download and subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts, be it Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon, most anywhere you get your podcasts. This show's long enough, so I'm going to sign off. For all you rock and rollers all over the world, be cool and stay safe.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.